In Florida, people continue to clean up from the four hurricanes which trampled through the state since the beginning of August. In the newspapers, the stories have moved from heroic survival and devastating loss to damage assessment and stoic rebuilding. Those who live on the Florida shoreline, like those who live in the floodplains or earthquake zones or on the edge of forests, accept risk as a part of their location. But how well do people understand what they're gambling with? And who really ends up paying the cost? Today, we look at the impact recent hurricanes have had on Florida for both its citizens and its ecosystems, and we'll talk about the risks and incentives of living in hazardous areas. Later on, the risks of the anti-inflammatory drug Vioxx and why it was pulled from shelves. But first, we want to hear from our listeners along the Florida and Gulf coastlines. Did the beaches near where you live sustain damage? Will your community be undertaking beach rehabilitation? Give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. With us now to talk about the environmental damage in Florida and how extensive it is Stephen Letterman, also known as Dr. Beach. His more official title is Director of the Laboratory for Coastal Research at Florida International University. He joins us from Marco Island in Florida. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
So how bad is it for the beaches in Florida?
Well, these beta 4 hurricanes certainly inflicted a lot of damage. I mean, we look here on the Gulf Coast, the worst hit area would be Pensacola Beach, but the damage extended, of course, to Panama City, and of course Alabama took it right on the nose. That's where the landfall was. So we're looking at Orange Beach and Gulf Shores, and heavily damaged. Many of the buildings are beyond repair or completely missing. I'm down here in Marco Island, and just north of me a ways in Lee County and Charlotte County, there's quite a bit of local damage on the beach. Fort Myers Beach is gone. Basically, Fort Myers doesn't have a beach anymore.
Well, when you say it's gone, you mean the water is lapping right up against
the seawall.
The seawall.
Right.
Oh, my.
Right up to the seawall. I was just out there recently, and there is no beach in large stretches. And, of course, I'm here at actually a conference right now talking about beach restoration and the storm damage and what to do. And the state of Florida, of course, wants to move ahead and restore that beach because it gets it's a city beach, an urban beach that has a lot of visitation, particularly in the wintertime. We move on the west coast, and this latest hurricane did a lot of damage in marine land and Vero Beach. A number of houses fell in, even roads were undermined. So pretty heavy damage up there, even Broward County. Hollywood Beach had a very thin beach before the hurricanes began, the spate of hurricanes, and some areas don't have much left. So, remarkably, Miami, which is sort of known as Hurricane Capital where I live, the beaches did quite well because everything went by us. So, it's across the state. It's not all the beaches. Not everything's knocked out. People here from Clearwater and their beaches actually did quite well because they're on the weak side of the hurricane and really got offshore winds when Charlie made landfall. That's the first of the hurricanes. So, It's pretty spotty, but where it's bad, there's some major damage done both to, of course, the beach itself, but also to the infrastructure, roads and facilities.
Now, if my Florida geography is right, you're not too far from Sanibel and Captiva Islands, which are over a bridge from Fort Myers. Is that right?
Well, I'm a bit further south than that.
Uh-huh.
Marco Island is the last island here in the chain of barrier islands, and so I'm south of Naples, actually.
Oh, okay. Barrier islands are called barrier islands because I guess they are considered a barrier for the main effect of the sea coming in. What happens to them in a hurricane? I gather that Captiva at least got hit pretty hard.
Yes, Captiva was, parts of it were very much affected. The famous South Seas Plantation have a very heavy hit on the north end of the island. The beach is pretty well flattened, and so they're really out of commission for a while. In fact, this conference was supposed to be at the South Seas Plantation on Captiva Island, and for obvious reasons, the hotels are closed there. North Captiva Island, which is only accessible by boat, had an inlet actually breach it in half. In fact, a lot of the inlets here in the Gulf Coast were formed by hurricanes, and so this is nothing new, actually. This has been going on for recorded time. The problem, what is new, of course, is we have so much development here, and there's so much invested in the real estate along the edge, along the delicate edge.
Does real estate development along a barrier island make the damage from a hurricane worse?
I'm not sure it makes it worse per se, except that when we try to stop the erosion, of course, sometimes seawalls and other devices are built, and so in that case, where a beach is trapped between the waves and the seawall, it doesn't take and you have an ongoing erosion problem. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out sooner or later you'll lose a beach, and that's what we see at Fort Myers. And so, the only solution it seems now is to pump sand in and restore the beach, or you wouldn't have a beach. And if you don't have a beach, then tourism's going to dry up, and tourism is the lifeblood of most of these economies on these beach towns.
We're talking about the devastation in Florida caused by the spate of, I think you can call four a spate, anyway, spate of hurricanes that have hit the state in the last month or a month and a half. And we'd like to hear from you. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And let's take a call now from Julie in Sanibel Island, Florida. Julie, welcome to the program.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome. You're just south of Captiva. What happened over there?
Well, we're just barely off of where it made landfall, and we had a lot of damage, but not nearly the structural damage that Captiva got.
Uh-huh. And I mean, what about you personally? Did your house survive or?
Yeah, my house is right on Clam Bayou, which is on the Gulf side, real close to the Gulf, and a lot of minor damage, nothing that can't be repaired. And the reason I called is I want to let people know that the beaches are still absolutely gorgeous here. The shelling, we're known for our shelling around the world, and the shells on Sanibel and Captiva's beaches they're the best I've seen in the 9 years I've lived here.
Wow. So you're saying that it was worth it, or would you rather have not gone through that experience?
Well, actually, a hurricane is a natural thing, and if the humans weren't around, it's a natural thing that happens, you know. And so if people just realize that, and you know, it's difficult to rebuild. But if you can think of it in that context, it's you know, it's easier to take, I think.
I see. Okay, Julie, thanks very much for the call.
Thanks so much.
Oh, sure. Go ahead, Stephen Leatherman.
She's absolutely right. The storm waves would have quarried quite a few more shells from the offshore area and brought them ashore. So after storms is the best time to go shelling, for sure. And Sanibel is the number one shelling location in the country. We talk about the Sanibel Stoop. Everybody leaned over picking up shells all the time. The other thing about Sanibel, which is interesting, is in their master plan, which was written by John Clark, a good friend of mine, back in the 1970s, he put in there no building be higher than the palm trees. So you don't have high rises or even mid rises on Sanibel. And there's also a large setback. So the dunes are not large there, but they have a considerable setback from the houses, the first row of houses, between them and the high water line. So you have a wide beach, and you got a sand dune, and then usually trees and a little bit of forest, and then the building. So, and those trees actually, unless one fell, tend to shed the wind, so you don't get the turbulent vortices close to the houses. So really, Sanibel, even though it was in pretty high wind zone, fared very, very well for all those reasons. By contrast, North Captiva, those are sort of mid-rise buildings, and they're really exposed on the north end of the island. Of course, that was also closer to the eye wall of this very intense but very small hurricane, so therefore the much increased damage.
Just because I've been there, but Ding Darling Wildlife Refuge, was that destroyed or damaged, or did the wildlife survive? And are there any wildlife damage from this storm, or are they built for this kind of thing?
Well, again, Florida is known for hurricanes, and so I would certainly, some birds died and some other things did perish, but not to the point of anything beyond that can't be recovered. So wildlife do very well, typically. You know, the birds sort of hunker down, and everybody kind of, they feel the pressure drop, and they realize something's up before they even feel the high wind. So I'm sure that refuge lost some trees. I saw some things turned over. But, again, this is all part of the natural system, so nothing that is out of the ordinary. Everything can fully recover.
All right. Let's take another call. Let's go to Matthew in Charlotte, North Carolina. Welcome to the program.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
I'm driving from Indy Atlantic, Florida, up to my alma mater, Virginia Tech, in Blacksburg, Virginia, to escape the lack of electricity, which is a problem that's plaguing many Floridians right now.
Uh-huh. And where, so you were living, where exactly is that community you were describing?
In the Atlantic, Florida, is on a barrier island. It is between Cocoa Beach and Melbourne Beach. It's across the 192 Causeway from Melbourne, Florida.
I got it. And which hurricane did the most damage for you?
Certainly Jean was worse, but Francis did a lot of beach erosion as well. And my question for Dr. Beach is, why do we always get such large storm surge predictions that don't really seem to come to pass for our area? Each storm was predicted to have a 10 to 20-foot storm surge, and we only had 2 or 3 feet, possibly as high as 6 feet with Jean.
Okay, Matthew, interesting. Is that correct, Dr. Leatherman?
That's a good observation. Actually, Jean came in during low tide, so you sort of knock off 3 feet there to get you back up to the high tide level. And also, I think the surge numbers, I've never heard 20 feet. We did our own calculations that the high surges we were going to see are 5 to 7, so... Again, I think there were. This storm was a very diffuse storm. It had a 140-mile diameter radius of maximum hurricane winds. That's very large. It was a very, very large storm in size. But actually, when it made landfall, it lost a lot of its wind speed and came in more as a Category 2 or less. So even though it did quite a bit of damage, it's not the type of storm which would typically generate the much larger storm surges. Now, if you look at what Ivan did, by contrast, it came in as a Category 3. And also the panhandle of Florida, if you've ever been to those beaches, they're very flat and very shallow water. That shallowness of the water actually helps the surge or helps the surge build up much higher. So we had about a 15 to 17-foot storm surge in Pensacola area and the Alabama coast, which is why it was so devastating. So the gentleman is absolutely right that off of Indiana Beach, it really drops off fairly quickly offshore, and so we really wouldn't expect those type of high surges anyway, and with the nature of the storm, it wouldn't have gotten those surges. So I think there were some spurious numbers batted around by people, and I think in the heat of the moment, you might say, some observers make those kind of ballpark numbers, which really are way too high. And I think we need to be a little more careful in that.
Okay, Matthew, thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Keith in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Welcome to the program.
Hi, just a quick question. I'm curious, we're talking about restoring the beaches and pumping all the sand back in. Who pays for that?
Good question. Keith, Dr. Leatherman, what about that?
Well, the state of Florida has a dedicated fund for beach nourishment, but if you look at the real cost breakdown, it's 65% federal government. Then the balance of 35% is largely, 65%, let's just start at the top again, 65% of it's feds, 25 to 30% state government, and then the locals are 5 to 10%. It varies. So really it's you and I and everybody else paying for this beach nourishment.
I got it. All right. Well, is there really anything, I mean, is it just a case of you have to do this each time? You know, the sand gets knocked down, you put some more in, it gets knocked down, or is there some long-term fix?
Well, there's several things going on here. One is that we will get recovery of some of these beaches, but it will not be until spring late spring when we get the type of waves called swell-type waves that bring the sand ashore. Right now, large quantities of sand are stored offshore in bars, underwater bars. And what we had with the two hurricanes coming ashore in the same location, that is Francis and followed later by Jean, is that we saw progressive erosion occur. And that's something that's been very problematic in Vero Beach and some other areas. We saw houses just collapse and marine land all through there and in the Atlantic and even down farther in Palm Beach County.
Okay, Dr. Leatherman, I'm afraid I have to stop you there because we need to take a break. And I thank you for joining us this afternoon.
My pleasure.
Stephen Leatherman is Director of the Laboratory for Coastal Research at Florida International University. Talking about beach erosion and hurricanes, I'm Joe Palca. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Stay with us. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Joe Palca in Washington. We're talking about people who choose to live in areas with a high risk from natural disasters. Who bears the cost when the worst comes to pass? You're invited to join the discussion if you work in the insurance industry or in the local disaster planning. How well do people understand their risks? And is the system set up to encourage them to live in safer places? Give us a call. Our number is 800-989-TALK. That's 800-989-8255. Our email address is TOTN at NPR.org. Many of us who live in the rest of the country might marvel at the tenacity of Floridians who weather hurricane season year after year, but the truth is, a large percentage of the population lives at risk of one kind or of a natural disaster or another, and many more of us probably wish we did. The riskiest places just happen to be some of the most beautiful, the banks of the babbling brook, which occasionally floods, the fringes of the forest, which sometimes catches fire. The question is, who bears the burden of the risk of living in one of these beautiful but perhaps perilous places? With us now is Dennis Miletti, retired director of the Natural Hazard Research and Applications Information Center at the University of Colorado, and the author of Disasters by Design, a reassessment of natural hazards in the United States. He joins us from the studios of KPSI in Palm Springs. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
So we just heard a discussion about the destruction in Florida. Why do people there keep building in such a risky area? And maybe the answer is simple as it's nice to live there most of the time.
Well, that's certainly, I'm sure, one of the reasons people go to Florida. But in general, the real answer is they're human beings. And human beings are wired in a particular way that has them discount low probability, high consequence events like hurricanes. We really, as a general rule, don't take those sorts of extremes into account when we make decisions about where to live.
Well, but actually, since you bring it up, I mean, there's a lot of people who are terrified of flying, but even though that's a low probability, high risk event, and some of them can't even bring themselves to get onto airplanes.
That's right. And the psychologists have a name for that, and it's in the category of diseases.
Uh-huh. Okay, so you're saying that if you're so obsessed with the concern that something bad will happen, it's not a normal state.
Psychologists say that. I'm a sociologist, so I'll let them have that categorization.
Okay.
But in general, yes.
All right. So, but right afterwards, certainly the memory must be painfully clear for people in Florida, and they can't have discounted it so much to start banging a nail into a board and rebuilding a house. So do they just say, well, I'll just forget about it?
How most people process information about risk is after an event, if you're a member of the public, it's a much more salient issue than it was before the event. But the salience of it decays and decays quickly. Mm-hmm. If there isn't another hurricane in Florida, and we did some polls over time, we'd probably find out that in 2 years, most people's degree of concern about the hurricane hazard would be back to where it was a few months ago.
Hmm. So whose responsibility is it to help people rebuild? Should people have to take this upon themselves and acknowledge whether they do it psychologically or just economically, that they live in a high-risk area and it's going to cost them a lot of money from time to time to repair the damage?
Well, our federal government has always come to the aid of disaster victims and provided that which needed to be provided to put lives back together. So by choice, our society as a whole helps people who need help from natural disasters.
Okay, we have an email here from Tom who writes, I live in Jacksonville, Florida, 18 miles from the ocean. Although we have not had a direct hurricane hit since Dora over 40 years ago, we have had trouble finding affordable property insurance. After Hurricane Andrew hit Homestead, our insurance company dropped all three of our insured properties. We had to go on to the very expensive state-run property insurance program. After several years there, the state, using a $500 per property cash incentive, convinced Florida Family Insurance to pick up our three properties. Their rates were and as bad as the state's program. I feel that we are subsidizing the rates of those who live at or near the beaches. So, you were talking about the federal government subsidizing, but this is a case where somebody locally within the state of Florida is subsidizing, or is he misunderstanding the way the insurance industry works?
I don't think he is. In general, it's my understanding that every person in the country is in some way subsidizing people who need to have insurance payouts after a disaster.
I see. But how much, I mean, do people have an idea of how much they're paying? Is it obvious, for example, that somebody in Washington, D.C. is helping to underwrite the cost of somebody living in southern Florida?
Absolutely not. No, people don't think about those sorts of things.
Should they?
Well, I hate to use the word should,
okay,
because then that's my value, and there's 265 million more people in the country. But in general, in our society, most of us are at risk to some perils, and an insurance plan of any sort is a mechanism for spreading the costs of those risks when they turn into actual events amongst non-victims. So by definition, insurance pushes the cost of losses onto people who had none.
Okay, let's take a call. Let's go to Bruce in Athens, Ohio. Bruce, welcome to the program.
Hey, I'm not calling from a cell phone.
Oh, that's
Aren't
a good thing,
happy?
And I'm happy you're not driving.
When I was 14, my family moved to Florida in 1978, so do the math. And when we first moved there, they were warning every year, you know, there's going to be a hurricane, there's going to be a big hurricane, it's bound to come. Between that time and I've lived back in Ohio now, I'm safe from hurricanes, there was one time there was an evacuation. This year, my parents still live down there. They've had 5 evacuations in the Tampa Bay area.
Yeah.
And it just seems that people kind of get the feeling that, you know, we know there's going to be hurricanes, but I doubt if it'll hit us. And now, with it being, you know, over, I guess the last one was in the 20s that a major hurricane really hit, that people kind of have the feeling that they're safe. And unfortunately, even with New Orleans, that they finally got some evacuations and how dangerous it is there with how low it is. And just it's just so sad that the warnings come. People have left these last few years, but just the worry that they're not going to evacuate like they need to.
Well, Dennis Miletti, is this the kind of denial that Bruce is describing, the kind of denial you were talking about?
Bruce hit the nail right on the head. And in general, the phenomenon is this, and it exists inside of all of us as human beings. We don't think low probability, high consequence events are going to happen to us. So if we're living on a coastal beach in Florida, we probably would think, if there are hurricanes here, it won't be while I'm in the house. It'll be after. It won't happen to me. It's the same phenomenon that enables us to cross streets, even though we know people get hit by cars and buses. Same phenomenon that enables us, most of us, that is, to get on an airplane, even though we know airplanes crash. We believe it won't be that plane and that flight. And that's why, if we as a nation, or we as a state, or we as a local community are interested in reducing losses from natural hazards, which, by the way, are on the incline, the burden really lies on larger levels of human aggregation than individuals or families. It really... We need sound leadership from our state and federal governments.
Well, Bruce, you may be safe in Ohio from hurricanes, but of course you do have the presidential candidates trampling all over your state, so there are hazards. Anyway, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
And speaking of the federal government's responsibility, we're joined now by the acting director for the Mitigation Division of FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, David Marstead. He comes to us from their headquarters here in Washington, D.C. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. Now, mitigation is the idea of lowering the damage from a potential natural disaster. What are the main campaigns for doing that?
Well, we work with state and local governments and, quite frankly, the educational community to try to assess and identify and do what we can to reduce the threats associated with what is assessed and identified so that we can minimize the opportunity for loss to property or loss of life.
So what if somebody comes to FEMA and says, look, I understand, and this is, you know, an impossible situation, but somebody says, look, I live in a trailer home and I know it's in a dangerous area. Can FEMA help me move it to a safer place? I mean, is that the kind of thing that you're talking about in terms of mitigation?
Well, that is a mitigation activity, but what we would do and the way we're structured is to work with our state, territory, and tribal partners to work with their local governments to identify what their high priorities are. And then we provide funding through mitigation grants to them to help them address those priorities that they've identified at the local level.
I see. So what happens if someone lives in the hurricane corridor and they get hit year after year after year, or at least because their construction isn't very good each time, even a tropical storm is enough to do them damage, and they keep applying to FEMA for help? Do you just have to keep bailing them out?
Well, what we try to do is after a disaster such as that, work with the local communities again in land use and code enforcement and floodplain management, so that they can move folks out of harm's way, so that we can reduce the number of repetitive loss properties across the country.
I see. Does FEMA have any stick to get people to move, or they just have to use friendly advice and try to convince people that it's in their best interest?
Well, the one program that we do have that is intended to try to address the situation you identified is the National Flood Insurance Program, and communities again determine on their own to participate in the flood insurance program. And when they become a participating community, it means that they will, as I indicated earlier, enforce floodplain management regulations. In that way, we're able to reduce the number of properties in the floodplain. Also, a part of the National Flood Insurance Program is the National Flood, part of that is the National Flood Insurance Program, and which is required by any property that has a mortgage that's federally backed. And the premium associated with that, in many people's minds, is a disincentive. And so that's it's not necessarily a stick, but it's a way to try to transfer some of the responsibility for where they choose to live to the property owner.
Okay. Last year, FEMA became part of the Department of Homeland Security, and some critics contend the new focus on terrorism has eroded your ability to do this kind of mitigation work. How do you respond to that?
Well, I don't think that's the case. I think that we've been able to become a part of 24 other entities and call on their expertise in areas, and also specifically with terrorism, take an all-hazards approach and leverage what we know about natural hazards to help identify man-made risks and how to go about alleviating the damages associated with those man-made risks. So I think it's been advantageous to become a part of the Department of Homeland Security.
All right. Thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
David Marstead is the acting director of the Mitigation Division at FEMA. He joins us. He came to us from their headquarters here in Washington, D.C. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're talking this hour about the effects of natural disasters on people and ecology, and a little bit about what kind of mitigation steps people can take or society can take in terms of who bears the responsibility for these. And we're still joined by Dennis Maletti, who's the retired director of the Natural Hazard Research and Applications Information Center at the University of Colorado. And we're taking your calls at 800-989-8255. So why don't we go to Keith in Berkeley, California. Keith, welcome to the program.
Hi, I just had a comment. I used to live in the Angeles National Forest, which, as you may know, is prone to forest fires. And when I was there, I was a renter and tried to go out to insurance companies and get insurance for fire, and was told that I couldn't get that insurance because I lived in an area prone to forest fires. And so I was looking to take responsibility, but couldn't find anyone who was willing to give me the insurance policy. And I'm just, calling to make a comment to see maybe if your expert could say something to that.
Well, thank you, Keith, very much. Dennis Maletti, what about that?
Well, first, regarding fires, we're talking about the most vulnerable part of the urban-wildland interface, we've known, and experts that know about fire have known for a long time, that there are only three things people need to do to protect their homes from burning in a fire in the interface. The first is the kind of roof they have. The second is the kind of siding they have. And the third is the amount of vegetation clearance that's provided between the structure itself and the very first shrub or tree or plant that's growing. Armed with those three weapons, you can keep any house from burning, or just about. And there were examples, for example, in the Oakland Hills fires, where people had those three mitigations in place and their homes didn't burn. Nevertheless, those requirements are rarely turned to or required in localities when decision makers are deciding what's required to build in the urban wildland interface. So those mitigations could actually reduce what's lost in a fire. That's very different than insurance. Insurance doesn't reduce losses, it just redistributes who pays for them. And for those of us in a career committed to natural hazards mitigation, although we certainly don't want to turn our back on insurance, the actual mitigation of losses or avoidance of them is much more salient an issue for us.
And I take it that the reason people don't follow these guidelines are expense and the difficulty and the cost. I guess it often comes back to in implementing them.
It is more costly because you're absolutely right. And so, for example, the Natural Hazard Center, which is on the Front Range of Colorado, that area of Colorado is experiencing dramatic growth in its urban wildland interface. Californians are moving there with lots of money from selling expensive homes and building many estates in the trees and bushes. And Colorado is designing dramatic fire losses into its future. Might not happen in 50 years, might not be for 100 years, but we're making decisions today that's going to increase the salience of that hazard in that state in the future.
Okay, thank you very much for joining us. Dennis Miletti is the author of Disasters by Design, a Reassessment of Natural Hazards in the United States, and former director of the Natural Hazard Research and Applications Information Center, University of Colorado. He joined us from the studios of KPSI in Palm Springs. When we come back from a short break, the arthritis drug Vioxx, once hailed as a breakthrough, is being pulled from the market. Physician joins us to answer your questions. I'm Joe Palca. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.